Committee, good afternoon, and thank you for being here. Ladies and gentlemen, we again ask you to turn off any cell phones you may have. That quiets it down considerably. This committee is aware of the contentious nature of House Bill 3013. And with that in mind, the chair has determined that certain rules will apply to those presenting testimony. First and most importantly, this committee will deal with policy issue only. While those giving testimony may use a site-specific situation to make their point, we would appreciate that you tie it to the change in policy that you would deem your testimony is aimed at. In an effort to present both sides of this issue as equitable as possible, we shall allocate time to speakers on an issue basis. Each panel of speakers will be awarded 5 minutes total, unless otherwise advised by the chair. Mr. Kelly, the administrator to my right, will verbally interrupt you at 4 minutes to advise you that you have 1 minute remaining. And that's because we want to get the testimony of everyone that we have invited to speak today. We want to be sure and get that in before the moon sets or the moon comes up. Committee members, I ask you to hold questions until we have received all of the invited testimony, of which we have some 21 different people invited to speak today. So we, with that in mind, we will start. Any comments from any committee members before we begin? Seeing none, I'll ask Mr. Egan from the Legislative Liaison of the Governor's Office. And good afternoon, Pat, and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Pat Egan. I'm Legislative Director and Transportation Policy Director for Governor Kulongoski. I don't think I'll have a problem staying within the five-minute directive, and just here to make a presentation on a couple of angles and our interest in this a couple of angles. First is wearing my transportation hat. The Department of Transportation obviously is a consumer and owner in some cases of the aggregate products, and we would like to see some level of resolution on this during session, and obviously you would as well, given that you've met on this several times. Second, as policy advisor, this is an issue that's been hanging at fire for some time, and there's a component of some of the compromises that I've heard of that I think we would certainly like to support, and that's an interim effort at work group at a long-term fix on this, and we've discussed the composition of that work group, and for the record, obviously, we would like to have representation on that as well as state agencies and all the various stakeholders, and I would trust that would be something that would be in the interest of you and every member of this committee, and so be happy to talk about that at more length if you would like. As to some of the individual provisions, it's my understanding that this will not be the last meeting of this conference committee, and so there's still more work to be done in the near term, and to get some clarity from us, which you've been waiting for a while. There are a couple of things I'd like to just state. One is there's a compromise that we have talked to various parties about and that others, I think, have seen fit to support, and that is how conditional use permits might be addressed. We've offered that in the Willamette Valley and in Columbia County that conditional use permits would be available on Class 1 and 1 and 2 soils, and that outside the Willamette Valley and outside Columbia County for 100,000 tons and above, conditional use permits could be utilized. We would support that, and so just offer that up for your work group as you work through this in the next couple of days. Second of all, the Eugene Sand and Gravel case has come up, obviously, and there's some discussion about how the dust issue could be dealt with. We would obviously be interested in working with you on a compromise there.
to address some of those issues. Obviously, DLCD has had a rule in place that's deferred to DEQ on the health standards. Whether that's the right resolution or not, I'm not prepared to sit here and tell you today, but I do believe that could be worked out, and I guess I'm hearing good signals on that. Finally, just again to get back to that interim work group, there are multiple issues and parties to this, and again, just to state for the record, I think it would be our interest and the interest of all stakeholders that have full representation, and the way that the proposal is constructed now, as I understand it, would be to have a legislative task force. I certainly would support that and think that would be a good thing, but again, our participation and broader participation, including local governments, I think would be a very positive thing. So with that, prepared to answer any questions you might have.
Committee have any questions for Mr. Eager? Seeing none, thank you, Pat, very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. Representative Johnson. We're not going to cut you off, Betsy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state representative from House District 31. I'm at a bit of a disadvantage sitting before you today because I'm not quite sure what set of proposed concepts I'm even responding to. This has been a very quickly unfolding process with lots of different drafts and ideas and lots of different folks at the table. The last set of concepts that I have attempted to address may not even be what's before you. So having listened to Mr. Egan, I think what I'm mainly here in support of is some kind of an interim committee that would look at what is a very complex issue. The very fact that almost every seat behind me is full is testimony to how complex this is. My county happens to be one of those, or one of the counties that I represent, happens to be rich in gravel deposits. And we have struggled as municipalities and as the county in Columbia County working through lots of issues that have resulted in series of litigation costing thousands, if not millions, of dollars. And so what I really am here to urge the committee is to give those of us that are deeply interested in this issue ample time to thoughtfully reflect on the ideas that are being brought forward. Again, to reiterate, this close to the end of a session, the rush to try to get a final product out frequently results in unintended consequences, and that's why I very much appear before you today as an advocate for an inclusive interim look at this complex issue. I have some written testimony that I would be prepared to soldier through, but given that I may be responding to something that is not before you, I'm not completely sure how useful it would be. I think the things that we are particularly concerned about in Columbia County is that we have a process that has potential mining sites included on some kind of a comprehensive plan so that people, and our plan happened to have been adopted in 1984, that then all parties have the assurance of knowing where significant sites are and can make local plans accordingly. The LC draft, the number 2203 that I saw, appears to remove the requirement that a mining site be on a list. And that, I think, is the source, or that could be the potential source, of enormous confusion and subsequent problems resulting in litigation. If it is the will of the committee that I offer the comments that I have based on LC 2203, I'd be happy to do that. I could provide it to you in writing, given that for your review off this setting, given the number of people that want to testify. Mr. Chair, I would do whatever you deem most worthwhile to move this along this afternoon.
Does the committee have a design?
Suggestion.
Representative Morgan.
Representative Johnson, you have your written comments ready to give to us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, actually I have one copy, not knowing whether or not I was going to deliver them. I can easily go up and beautify them and bring them down for committee consumption.
Mr. Chair, given the changing nature of the discussion and the demands on Representative Johnson's time, would it be permissible to just have her give her copy in and we could make copies and distribute them to the members of the committee?
I think that would be most appropriate.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, Representative Morgan, I appreciate that suggestion. I still just out of a matter of personal pride, feel as though I need to go up and doctor this up a bit where I have all sorts of marginalia that I would prefer to clean up for the benefit of the committee. And I can do that expeditiously, and I would return momentarily.
I would, Mr. Chair, be interested in having the comments somehow introduced into the proceedings.
I'll get them back to you in the next few minutes. But, again, I'm responding to LC2203, and I don't know if that's even what's before the committee at this point.
If you'd like to bring it to staff, they can copy. Whenever you have a presentable document, Representative.
I'm assuming, Mr. Chair, that it's that grocery list off the side that needs to be...
Yeah, we don't need the grocery list on the side, Representative.
Regrettably, Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan and I sit next to each other in committee, and she's seen the tomatoes, lettuce on...
Senator Shields had a question.
Quite simply, the question, marginalia, do you have a patent on that word? I've never heard it before.
Mr. Chair and Senator Shields, I do not have a patent, and I give you leave to use it without attribution.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
I can join the dubiosity.
Well, that sets the pace for this afternoon, that exchange. Rich Engstrom.
Good afternoon. I am Rich Engstrom, the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. OCAPA represents construction and construction materials companies throughout Oregon. Our organization has about 160 members statewide, including aggregate, asphalt, and concrete producers. This has been kind of a long road to this point. A lot of good ideas have been on the table and a lot of work. I know it's also a highly emotional and contentious issue. The legislature has literally dealt with contentious aggregate issues in every session I've been here. I think it's interesting that how we couch this debate. A lot of folks couch it as an aggregate versus agriculture debate. And in my mind, it really is, from the policy side of things, it really isn't that kind of debate. It really is about Oregon's resource lands, farm, forest, and mineral resources, and how we're going to allocate our resource lands to each of those individual natural resources. And I think when we do that and we back away from whether, you know, aggregate's going to be on agriculture land or on forestry land, the policy parts start popping out a little more clear. And I think it's helpful for the committee to understand what is transpiring in the industry at this point and how it's affecting our ability as businesses to survive and to provide local government, ODOT, and the communities of Oregon the necessary aggregates that they need to build strong communities. Unfortunately, we're one of the casualties and are fast becoming an increasing casualty of the listing of fish. On the coast, NOAA Fisheries is very concerned with the listing of salmonids. Are very concerned with the aggregate extraction out of Oregon waterways. And we have seen a trend, an increasing trend, of calling jeopardy on all of those aggregate resources. Essentially, by doing that, they dry up those permits and preclude any aggregate production on the coast. Unfortunately, the coast does not have very good quarry rock because it's all marine basalt, and there's a whole bunch of chemical reasons for marine basalt that was formed under the ocean, why it doesn't make good construction grade material. But to conclude on that point, though, is that the coast, our resources on the coast, are at this point drying up on us, which leaves us in an aggregate supply problem. The next thing that has happened was the Beaver State case, and the Beaver State case came out and essentially said that there was no statutory authority for granting conditional use permits in the state. And we've been through this because that was the original part of the bill, But the effect of that is that it would preclude all the small operators and those that wanted to go through the CUP process, the conditional use process, from having even a land use authority to be able to proceed and get a permit granted. This doesn't just affect the industry. This affects substantially ODOT, because ODOT has many sites that would go through the CUP process. It also affects the counties that also run most of their sites through a CUP process. Essentially, though, again, we dry up the supply of aggregate, both for the little aggregate operator as well as for the local and state government resource sites. The third issue came out was the Eugene Sand and Gravel issue. And Eugene Sand and Gravel, essentially, there's lots of parts to it, but the part that impacted industry was the interpretation of 296 that precludes the industry, when we're proposing an aggregate resource site, from having increasing the cost or having a significant impact on agriculture or agricultural products. And the problem that came out is that the opponents in the county pushed essentially a no-dust standard on the industry, that we could not increase the ambient dust level. And if we did, that would increase the cost of agriculture and agricultural production for minimally processed products. That also has a limiting effect on the supply of aggregate statewide, because we will not be able to make no dust, no increase in dust from our operations. We can meet EPA and DEQ standards for dust, but we can't meet a zero dust standard. All three of these cases, though, what they combine to do is they have a serious restriction not only on the supply of aggregate statewide, but also on the competition for aggregate resources that keeps the price affordable to state government. And that's kind of what Pat was getting at, is that it's important to have a number of sites out there competing, not just a monopoly, so there's a fair cost to aggregate statewide. On top of this, we end up passing a $2.5 billion highway package. And there's no question that sends the demand for aggregate through the roof. I think a couple of important statistics that's important for everybody to know. Government in the state uses approximately 60% of this state's production of aggregate. The state produces between 40 and 50 million tons a year. The cost of aggregate and building roads, from an ODOT study in Bend, ranges from 40 to 60%. So it's a pretty substantial component of the cost of building roads. For each additional mile that we're required to take aggregate, it increases the cost 25 cents per ton per mile.
1 minute.
When you get all of that, you put all of that together, you have a recipe for really pushing up the price of aggregate. Clearly, from our perspective, the system's out of balance. The industry really has no place to go in the future for aggregate resources. We need to take a long, hard look and get around the issue that the land use permit right now is the commodity. He who gets the land use permit is making the money. That's totally backwards from where it should be, which is the resource itself should be the commodity, not the land use permit. Now, the chair asked me, and with the chair's permission, it'll go a little longer to kind of walk through generally the broader pieces of the bill that I know are being probably going to be handed out here, because I saw Harrison Conley come in. And with the chair's permission, I know that would extend my time to walk through that so folks can hear from industry what our interpretation of the amended language is.
How long do you think that would take you?
I think I can do it within a couple of minutes.
Proceed.
The first section is a policy section. And in that section, we tried to grab and hold on to the policies of our goal system, which is that aggregate is a statewide resource. It's significant, and it needs to be protected. It's also in here that agriculture is of statewide importance and needs to be protected. And the policy section says it was necessary and appropriate basically to find a balance between aggregate and agriculture, and make sure that when we're doing it that we protect the residents and adjacent property owners from impacts from the mine. The second section in the bill, as we kind of thumb through it, it does have, and I'll just take this off the record right now, still has a few drafting errors that I've picked up that were not cleaned up on the last round. But essentially what it does is it says that if we comply with a local or a state standard, example, dust or dust noise or other discharges, that the provisions of 296 do not apply. If we meet DEQ's standards for noise and dust, that should end the discussion about impacts with agriculture. The third section is the Beaver State Fix, and it's not a lot different than what is in the A.N. Gross version, so I won't go into much detail, except the counties asked that the provisions for non-significant aggregate resource sites, the definition of under inventory, be changed slightly to work to accommodate their needs better, and the industry thought those were good changes, and those will be in the draft. The fourth section is the task force, and it directs basically that there'll be a 7-member task force. Hopefully many of you will be participants in that and be able to help steer an interim discussion on this and find a resolution to this issue for the entire state. The last section is fairly serious because it really broadens the protections for Class 1 and 2 soils statewide. Right now, the way the process works is the protections for Class 1 and 2 soils are only under the Goal 5 avenue. People that want to go through the conditional use process are not restricted on Class 1 and 2 soils. What this particular provision does is it picks up a lot of what's in the Goal 5 rule and carries it over and applies it throughout all sites. Both conditional use and significant aggregate resource sites, and this is a serious expansion of soils protections in the state. I think these measures are not perfect. I think they do restore balance. I think they set the stage for the interim discussion. They're a product of a lot of compromise. I can tell you that that last section was a significant discussion with our membership. We obviously are giving up something. There's no question we're closing a loophole that the industry has used to get around those. We're also extending those to the small aggregate producers. They're also going to it's going to be uniform. Big and little aggregate producers statewide are going to have the same restrictions on Class 1 and 2 soils. Mr. Chair, it concludes my testimony. Other than to say that I think this is a balanced approach. I don't think everybody's going to be necessarily happy with all provisions of it, but I think that's what happens in a legislative process.
Thank you for your testimony. Can you stick around in case the committee has questions?
I can, sir.
Thank you very much. We gave Mr. Angstrom a little extra time because we have 3 representatives of industry speaking and 11 people somewhat opposed to that point of view also speaking. So, again, we're trying to measure time and balance time. Mr. Art Schleck, AOC, Mike MacArthur. Judge Pryor, of course. Being a former county commissioner, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and with me here this afternoon are Judge Pryor from Gillam County and Judge MacArthur from Sherman County, and they have comments with respect to House Bill 3013 for you.
Chair Gerard and members of the committee, I'm Judge Mike MacArthur, Sherman County. My role here today is as chair of the Community Development Steering Committee for Association of Oregon Counties, which has jurisdiction over the issues that are before you today and 3013. And our Our committee has reviewed the Angress version of 3013 that passed the Senate, and we're in support of that. We understand that does satisfy the problem that was created with the Beaver State case. And we also want to say that our committee supports the retention of the authority for permitting at the local level. We feel like that's going to be something we have to deal with anyway. We think that that is essentially the essence of our land use system in Oregon, is those decisions need to be held at the local level. We understand that there are continued problems, as Mr. Engstrom said, with siting of aggregate sites, particularly in western Oregon. I must say that in my part of the country, in Sherman County, we have very little difficulty siting new aggregate sites, but that's not necessarily where the demand is, and we understand that problem. So with that, we would support any interim work that needs to be done to examine those further difficulties that are presented, and would hope that the committee would look at a balanced approach in terms of appointing a task force to have all the various interests represented, including those of local government. Be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Mr. Chair, if I might, just for clarification purposes, what I provided the chair, and I can have copies for the members of the committee at this point, is our suggestions for amendment of the Angross 3013 that would do basically a very simple, we believe, a simple fix to the Beaver State case. And that would be to maintain the requirement that significant sites go through the Goal 5 process and be on a list in an acknowledged comprehensive plan. The non-significant sites, those would be subject to a permit to be issued by local government, and they would be on a list that is maintained by the local government in the planning office at this point. That's a change from what is in the engrossed Senate version of the bill at this point. And I just wanted to clarify that for you.
Do you have copies of that, Art?
Yes, I do, and I'll provide those.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laura Pryor, and I'm the county judge from Gillam County, and I'm here today because I chair the Association of Oregon Counties Transportation Committee and was heavily involved in that process to get the bill out that is going to give us that huge bridge fix in Oregon, which is so badly needed. I'm just going to speak very briefly to the policy issue. And for us, for local government, the policy issue is, if you can get the Beaver State fix, that Oregon made a major policy decision when the conditional use permitting at the local level was included in the land use process. That allows you to do what you need to do at the local level. High-value farmland is already clearly defined in the conditional use process, in the land use process in Oregon. You don't need further definition of that. Unless you could figure out how I could get some Class 3 soils. If you can do that in the process, I'd be glad to entertain that. Counties urge you to maintain that policy. It works well. If there is an interim task force, we hope that we would be included in that process to further discuss this issue. But we urge you to maintain that conditional use process and decision-making at the local level where we're going to be dealing with the site. Thank you.
Rather than holding this distinguished panel, are there any questions from the committee?
Today I received in my desk a letter from the Lane County Board of Commissioners. Art, have you seen this letter? Would you like to respond to
it? Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, yes, I have seen that letter.
Would you like to respond to it in any way? The concerns it raises, local control, whatever.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I believe that letter that was submitted earlier expresses the opposition of the Lane County Board of County Commissioners to House Bill 3013. They wish to maintain local control, and they do not at this point see a reason to change the law.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, all of you.
Thank you.
let's see, Don Schellenberg, Connie Sherton, and Bill Austin. Is Connie Sherton or Bill Austin here? Oh, okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Schellenberg.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. There are two issues here that are being talked about today or will be discussed today. One is a short-term issue, and that deals with the Beaver State case in particular, perhaps the Eugene Sand and Gravel case as well. But there is the long-term issue, the global issue, if you will, that will also be discussed. My comments will be limited to the short term. That's the issue that we've been working with, trying to find a solution to. I'd like to also begin by emphasizing the fact that what we're talking about here is a farm zone. We're talking about what can be done in a farm zone. We're talking exclusive farm use zone. We're talking Goal 3. Now, the purpose of Goal 3 is to protect farmland for the purpose of farming. Now, having said that, the statutes do provide for non-farm uses in EFU zones. Some of those are permitted uses, some of those are conditional uses, and the issue that we're dealing with today is those that are identified as conditional use. With that, I'd like to read the testimony that I have here. Words are important. I wrote them carefully. I want to make sure I say them carefully. House Bill 3013, as introduced, addressed a LUBA decision that was upheld by the Oregon Court of Appeals. That decision did not overturn any law. It simply interpreted the language in ORS 215-298 regarding the process when there is an application to mine aggregate as a conditional use in an EFU zone. Such non-farm activity is allowed in a farm zone under ORS 215-213 sub 2, which is your marginal lands counties, and under 215.283 sub 2 in the rest of the counties in the state. The law clearly states in ORS 215-298 sub 2 that a permit for this non-farm mining activity in a farm zone shall be issued, quote, only for a site included on an inventory in an acknowledged comprehensive plan, end quote. In other words, a county must amend their comprehensive land use plan to add the applicant's site to the county's inventory of aggregate sites. The requirement for each county under Oregon's land use law is that they address each of the statewide land use goals. In the case of Goal 5, which protects natural resources, including aggregate, each county is required to create an inventory list of those resources that are significant and then protect them. In this case, aggregate is to be protected for mining. Some counties followed the law, some did not. Some counties created two inventory lists for aggregate, one for significant resource sites and one for non-significant resource sites, and some did not. The Goal 5 administrative rules define a site as significant in the Willamette Valley if it contains 2 million tons of quality aggregate, and outside the valley if it contains 100,000 tons of quality aggregate. What precipitated House Bill 3013 was the court decision that since the county comprehensive plan had to address all goals, including Goal 5, and put all significant resource sites on an inventory, then an aggregate resource site that was not significant could not be put on the inventory list. That had the potential effect of rendering existing county-approved conditional use sites illegal that did not qualify for the significant resource inventory list and prevented other non-significant sites from being mined as a conditional use. The response to the court was House Bill 3013, which eliminated the requirement to be on an inventory to be mined as a conditional use. House Bill 3013 is introduced went against the policy agreed to by the aggregate and agricultural industries and adopted as part of the Goal 5 rules. The policy allows the mining of aggregate on some of our best farmland only where they could get the most rock while destroying the least amount of farmland. Eliminating the inventory list requirement was unacceptable because then all of our best farmland in a farm zone could be destroyed regardless of the amount of aggregate at the site. The bill passed the House anyway. The bill passed the House anyway and then was amended in the Senate to provide for a significant resource site inventory list and a non-significant resource site inventory list. The result was just as bad. Now, instead of all farmland being available for mining because there was no requirement for a list, as under 3013 is introduced, all farmland is available for mining because it will qualify for one list or the other. Throughout this process, Farm Bureau has tried to find the middle ground where aggregate can still be mined while protecting some of our best farmland. We believe that our amendments strike that balance. Building on the Senate amendments, our proposed amendments do the following. And the -6 amendments, if you have them in front of you, the A6 amendments are not correct as we had drafted them. And if you allow me the time when I get there, I'll point out those differences. But what our intention was, number one, allow significant aggregate resource sites to be mined under Goal 5 as they are now. Number two, allow unlimited mining of non-significant aggregate resource sites as a conditional use on other than high-value farmlands. Number three, east of the Cascade Mountains, allow mining of a full 10 acres as a conditional use on high-value farmland. Number four, west of the Cascade Mountains, allow mining of a full 5 acres as a conditional use on high-value farmland. Number five, require sites in number three and number four to be at least 1 mile apart so they don't become a large site. And number six defines the mining area so the full 5 acres or 10 acres can be mined. It's important to note that neither the existing law before or after the court case nor the proposed legislation would preclude the siting of an aggregate site on lands zoned for other uses, such as forest land. And it's also important to note that a new site could also be proposed using the exceptions process, regardless of the zoning. There was early concern expressed that ODOT has hundreds of sites statewide, some of which may not have been properly approved, and because of the court decision would not be eligible for use. To the extent that such is the case, some would qualify as a non-conforming use. Under our proposed amendments, many would automatically qualify on other than high-value farmland, and some would qualify under number three and four as small sites. ODOT has indicated to us that they could operate under our proposed amendments. In conclusion, the court removed the ability to mine any non-significant site as a conditional use. House Bill 3013 is introduced, allowed unlimited mining on our best farmland as a conditional use. Our amendments allow unlimited mining on other than high-value farmland, and in addition to Goal 5 mining on our best farmland, we allow limited mining on our best farmland. I believe you would have to say that agriculture is giving more than middle ground between the court decision and House Bill 3013. The Oregon Farm Bureau respectfully requests that this conference committee adopt the A6 amendments to House Bill 3013. Do you have a copy of the A6 amendments?
I've got a copy. I don't know
if the rest of you do or not. Quickly, line 10, the last word in line 10 on page 1, the word is should be changed to may. That change needs to take place in any case. Down on line 21.
Representative Schaffer.
I'm sorry?
Mr. Schellenberg, do you mean is should be replaced with may be allowed?
Yes, I'm sorry, may be. Correct. Thank you.
You're in overtime, Don.
Thank you. I'll very quickly here. In line 21 and also in line 23, after the ORS site, you should add the word the mining area, because it was our intention that the whole mining area be mineable. On line 24, it says the commission shall define high-value farmland. The statutes already define high-value farmland. It was our intention to use that. They do not need to be redefined. And it's missing the definition of mining area that we had intended to be in the amendments. And that would conclude my testimony, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the extra time for your indulgence.
Well, your testimony is very important, Don. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Any questions of the committee or Mr. Schellenberg? Okay, thank you, Don. Ms. Skirton and Mr. Austin, you have 5 minutes between you, okay?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am Bill Austin. I live in Roseburg. And I'll start by saying I'm not opposed to aggregate mining. I buy aggregate products. I use them. I'm only opposed to destroying Oregon's best land in order to get those. And I won't go through the part of my testimony that says why House Bill 3013 was derived. It's well known. I'll go on. I don't believe that aggregate mining permitting decisions should be transferred to the state from the county level, as OCAPA has proposed. Local governments are in a position to know the condition and needs of their citizens, while state government is further removed and less qualified to make decisions on local areas. The aggregate industry would have you believe that alluvial rock, which naturally is often located under our best agricultural land, is the only aggregate that will meet needs for road and other construction. This is misleading. Do you know that according to the Departments of Transportation, at least two states, Florida and Georgia, have no alluvial rock at all? And according to a paper entitled Aggregate Mining in the U.S., of the top 10 aggregate-producing states in 1993, Florida ranked number 3 and Georgia ranked number 8, with no alluvial rock. This indicates that quarry rock can be and is used extensively in these states. The same can be true for Oregon. We have in this state huge quantities of quarry rock. Much of it does meet the strict needs of the Oregon Department of Transportation. There are large areas that have not yet been explored, but I'm sure would meet the limited qualities of good material. Another statement I've heard from the aggregate industry is that aggregate must be located close to the point of use. Yet a press release by Montana Dakota Utilities, the parent company of Knife River Company, which owns Beaver State Sand and Gravel, on Tuesday, September 4, 2001, states, "The Springfield Quarry is a significant acquisition because it provides Knife River's Oregon construction companies with a long-term aggregate resource." They included Roseburg and Eugene in that statement. "The quarry is situated near a major interstate highway and has direct rail access." And this is referring to their purchase of Metro Rock, which they stated was a massive 139 million ton quarry. It's located at Springfield. Knife River also has stated that they have reduced shipping costs into Portland area by using the rail system. According to numerous press releases by Knife River Corporation, they claim to have a 40 to 50 year supply of aggregate on inventory at their present rates of consumption. I know how you, our legislators, have been struggling with the money issue and the budget, and I feel that farmland is kind of the same thing. We have a bank of farmland, and that bank is rapidly being depleted. According to an editorial in the Capital Press, in a five-year period, 84,000 acres of farmland was lost to other uses. That's three times the amount of Class 1 and 2 soil there is in Douglas County, where I come from. With that, the rest of my testimony is on paper. You will read it, I'm sure. I just would urge you to support the Farm Bureau's amendments. I believe that they are fair to everyone. And thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to speak.
Thank you for being here,
Mr. Chairman.
Question, Senator.
With reference, to, Mr. Austin, to the 84,000 acres lost to other uses, can you identify what those uses are?
It's all uses, I believe, of which, of course, the aggregate industry takes the best land mainly, but it was not broken down in the article in the Capital Press. This was from the Department of Agriculture, and it was for 5 years preceding 1993.
Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
Do you know how many acres are taken by aggregate mining of the 84,000?
I don't have that in hand, but I believe it averaged about 7,000 years it was permitted per year for a five-year period at in the early 1990s. I have it in my briefcase in back.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Austin? Ms. Sheridan.
Representative Garrard, members of the committee, thank you very much for inviting me to testify today. My name is Corinne Shertan. I'm an attorney with Johnson & Shertan, and I represented Mr. Austin and another Douglas County farmer, Bobby Wright, in the Beaver State sand and gravel case. So I'm very familiar with that, and you've heard a lot about that already today. I've given you my testimony in writing, and I know we don't have much time. I would point out, too, that I've attached a table to my testimony that shows a comparison of what the current law is in the interpreting ORS 215-298 as interpreted by the Court of Appeals, what HB 3013 proposed, and what the Farm Bureau amendments that you have before you in the -A6 draft would propose. And we have worked with the Farm Bureau on these amendments, and we feel they represent a very reasonable compromise between the interests of agricultural industry and the aggregate industry. And we would urge you to adopt them as either a permanent solution to
the
dilemma or as an interim measure while you create your task force to study this matter further over the interim. It's unfortunate that we have not been able to see in advance the amendments that have been submitted to you by OCAPA and by the Association of Oregon Counties, so I cannot comment directly on those. But I would tell you that one statement that's been made here today is by Mr. Angstrom is that the current law gives no protection to Class 1 and 2 soils in the conditional use permit process. And that would be incorrect because, according to the Court of Appeals, the current law is that conditional use permits cannot be issued except for significant sites that are on Goal 5 inventories. And there is protection for Class 1 and 2 soils built into that process. So we're looking at a compromise that would allow permits for mining to be issued on soils that are not high-value farmland and would limit permits on soils that are high-value farmland to small, locally needed operations.
Time.
Of course, the large operations could still use the Goal 5 process. Thank you.
Any questions of Ms. Shertan? Thank you again for coming in and, sure. And making the trip. Kerry McLaren and Jennifer Flynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kerry McLaren, staff attorney for 1000 Friends of Oregon. Mr. Schellenberg did walk you through the amendments that have been proposed by the Farm Bureau together with some of the errors in the A6 draft before you. I want to make it clear at the outset, I think as many of you do know, that 1000 Friends of Oregon has supported and signed on to those amendments. We do this because we do think that it strikes an appropriate balance between between what many thought was the case before Beaver State versus what the state of current law is, I think is well depicted in the table handed out by Ms. Shertan. I guess I should start my statements by saying that, as many of you know, this is an issue that matters greatly to farmers. It also matters to Oregonians across the state. Many of these aggregate mines can be located near cities and near communities, and so there are impacts that they have to those areas as well. That said, my comments today are directed towards agricultural land and aggregate mining operations just on land zoned for exclusive farm use. What the Farm Bureau's amendments do that I think is critical is they look at the amendment, there are the inventories that counties have of aggregate sites already identified on their comprehensive plan and say that those sites are deemed to be on an inventory for purposes of conditional use permit mining. What Section 5, is it really Section 5 in here? Yes. In Section 5 does is to address how do we identify new conditional use permit sites or new sites to be placed on an inventory in a county's comprehensive plan. And it distinguishes, as many of our land use statutes and administrative rules do, between high-value farmland and non-high-value farmland. It allows small mining to occur on our high-value farmland with some protections in terms of the amount of acreage that may be lost to that mining operation. And it addresses two things that I think were raised by the Oregon Department of Transportation in their early testimony on this bill, which is that, one, they were concerned that small sites that may be placed in different locations around the state for repair or for sanding, for road safety, et cetera, may not be accessible in terms of their old sites now or in terms of new sites to go on. These amendments address that with the provisions that we have allowed. Secondarily, as many of you know, the Goal 5 process has certain standards for quality. And if you do not meet those quality standards, you're not deemed a significant site, and therefore you cannot avail yourself of the Goal 5 process. The amendments proposed by the Farm Bureau deal with this by virtue of allowing sites to be listed on an inventory subject to the conditions already explained, without any standards as to quality. I think these amendments go a very, very long way. And to be quite frank, there are many of our farmers and supporters who think that perhaps these amendments go too far. We've tried to address at least what could be an interim perspective to allow mining while protecting the state's best farmland. I want to address a couple of items. I am at somewhat of a loss to comment on the amendments that you may be considered or maybe before you by OCAPA and perhaps the counties. I do know that there are several different concepts which have been proposed, at least in conversations. One is the issue of providing a rule by which you cannot mine Class 1 or Class 2 farmland unless that area is reclaimed for farm use. None of the standards that I've seen, or none of the examples I've seen so far, propose any standards for what that reclamation or restoration means, back to original use or back just to some farm use. That is a substantial concern to us. I would also respectfully disagree with what Rich Engstrom described in terms of the protections afforded to you, at least in what I understood of his verbal testimony. As described, Class 1 and Class 2 farmland would be able to be mined as long as they were restored. That is significantly offers significantly less protection than the current Goal 5 provisions, and we cannot support amendments to do so. I don't think that that does strike a balance between the needs of agriculture and the needs of aggregate. Again, I have some additional comments explaining the Farm Bureau's amendments in my written testimony, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions of Ms. McCarron? Seeing none, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Garrard, members of the Conference Committee. I'm Jennifer Flint, representing the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. I have submitted to you in writing comments by Mitch Rose, president of this association, and I am actually trying to fill my boss's shoes today. Stephen Cofori apologizes for not being here. I hope I can do an adequate job of briefly conveying their position on this bill. To some extent, this testimony really shoots behind a rapidly moving target. It seems quite clear that the legislation that's currently before us won't look the same when we're all done. But briefly, I just want to say that the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association does support farmland protection as provided by Planning Goal 3 and related statutes. And OAPA strongly supports appropriate surface mining for aggregate and farm zones per Goal 5. However, the way the bill is currently drafted, the association feels that it goes a bit too far. And again, I'm going to stay away from the specifics on that because I'm not well versed in it as the other people here today are. I think the main concerns that the planners have are that this bill would enable an applicant to opt for the much less rigorous conditional use process, even for massive aggregate operation, and that's what we feel is most inappropriate. In summary, we recognize the need for legislation in this area, and we believe it's essential for such legislation to strike the proper balance between farmland use and allowing surface mining. If there is a work group that comes together, I know that the American Planning Association would love to be a part of that. Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thanks.
Very much. Ross Day and John Chandler. I'm not using the dynamic duo bit at all here.
He's a recovering lawyer, and I'm currently practicing addicted lawyer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record. Ross Day, Oregonians in Action. Here in support of House Bill 3013 and the amendments proposed by OCAPA, I have to admit I haven't seen the proposed amendments yet. I have worked on concept draft with Mr. Angstrom, and at least if the amendments are what we've worked on in the past, we're in full support of those amendments. I'm here on behalf, we've heard a lot about farmland. Most of our member supporters are farmers, those who actually own the property that we're talking about here. And these are farmers out there who own property that they can't otherwise do anything with. And the amendments, as I understand them, in House Bill 3013 will actually allow them to realize some economic value from their property. Other than that, I'm here basically to support the amendments and ask that you adopt them. Now with that, I'll let Mr. Chandler spew his words of wisdom.
I'm not sure.
Interesting juxtaposition.
You're right. I've chosen that verb. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Chandler with Legislative Advocates and OCAPA here on House Bill 3013. Rather than address any specific amendments that are floating around, I'd like to share what we've looked at in working on this bill. As you know, I've worked on land use issues for many, many years, been down a number of the Oregon land use systems rabbit holes. This process of siting aggregate mines, the conflicts with cities, urban dwellers, farming, was one of the absolute thickest messes in Oregon land use. And Oregon land use is full of thick messes. This one needs to be addressed once and for all, how one balances the various competing interests. And I want to make it very clear for the record, on behalf of OCAPA, we are not interested in a bill that says miners win. We're interested in a bill that tells miners what the process is, what they have to do, what steps, in what sequence. What we're trying to get to with the amendments to 3013 and in this conference committee is to recognize, and we couldn't agree more, there needs to be a balance between the interests of agriculture and urban dwellers and others that are affected by mines. At the same time, it's unfair, we believe, to have a process that's simply out of which you cannot get, which creates a cul-de-sac, which creates essentially a null set in terms of where the lawsuits have left us. I take my hat off to the folks who participated in these cases. It's not our intent to undo them or to change the policy behind them, but to set up a process that gets us to a result. So we know up front what the rules are, what's expected, and how we can comply. That's really what we're talking about, Mr. Chairman, and what I think we can bring back to this committee in the form of a piece of legislation. You've heard talk about an interim process, and absolutely, we've got to have an interim process on this because I have a great deal of respect for Ms. Chertan. She's one of the finest lawyers in the state, and she'll probably throw something at me what I'm about to say, but she doesn't need to make any more money on land use cases involving mines. Nor did I when I was in private practice. It is not necessarily a lawyer's game. It should be a planning process, a balanced one, that recognizes the interests of all the people involved. An interim process can get us there. In the meantime, though, there are two legal cul-de-sacs in which the industry has found itself. You've heard by case name, the Beaver State case, the Eugene Sand and Gravel case, both of whom, again, we're not trying to say that go back, wind the clock back, and those applicants would have won if the bill was passed then in an alternate universe. We're simply saying that as a result of those cases, the mining industry is stuck. We can't comply because of the way the law was written. That's what legislators are for. Legislatures are for is to fix those disconnects in the law. The courts did a good job interpreting what was written in rule and statute. It just turned out that we didn't cover all the eventualities when we did those in the first place. I was a participant in the Goal 5 rewrite a bunch of years ago. This is not the first place we found in that Goal 5 rule that, We thought we'd fix it. Turned out we didn't. And what we're submitting to you, Mr. Chairman, and we'll be bringing back to this committee, is language in the, that gets us, again, not a particular outcome. I want to make it real clear. We do not want to change the outcome so much as we want to make sure we have a process. We agree with the Farm Bureau on the need to balance the interests of agriculture. We don't agree with Farm Bureau that the Dash 6 amendments do that, but we are more than willing and looking forward to sitting down with Farm Bureau 1000 friends and the others you're going to hear from on coming up with that solution. I was pleased listening to the testimony you've heard that the recognition is there that we need to have this fixed, we need to have a balance, we need to make sure everybody involved knows what the rules are. In the issue of dust, for example, one of the things we've talked with some members of this committee and we'll put on the record, we would hope there wasn't a no-dust standard with regard to mining. I'm not sure agriculture would be happy with a no-dust standard because when I farmed, it was a tad dust.
1 minute.
Technology's changed. But if there was a no-dust standard, we'd argue against it, but at least we would know what it was. And the situation in which we find ourselves now is in one of, we don't know until it's too late to do anything about it what the standards are. That's not a good process. And we're here on behalf of OCAPA to ask this committee to work with us, with the work group, with other people involved in this, to come up with a bill that fixes this, sets up the interim process for a more thoughtful, in-depth discussion of how to strike this balance, and bring back a bill in the 2005 session, but in the meantime, to get us out of these particular boxes in which we found ourselves. We look forward to that. Thank you for your time today. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions for Mr. Chandler or Mr. Day? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Looks like I'm bringing up the Eugene Sand and Gravel team here, or the anti-team. Lee Kirsten, Laurie Jensen, Steve Pfeiffer.
It's taken care of. Everybody is free.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak and be invited today. My name is Laurie Jensen. I'm the president of Lone Pine Farms Limited. I'm a direct market farmer. I and other similar farmers in my neighborhood grow hundreds of different crops and varieties, especially fruits and vegetables, that we directly market to our customers at our farm markets. Farm markets in our area collectively have several thousand customers a day at peak season, gross millions of dollars in revenue annually, and employ a large workforce to make a decent living selling high-quality produce to the local customers. I cannot sell raspberries covered with dust, nor can I wash them as they will be ruined. I cannot sell dusty peaches. Dust increases disease and decreases photosynthesis. We are farmers. As farmers are trying to decrease chemical application, not increase it. HB 3013 is the end run to Eugene Sand and Gravel's denial. Their application was unneeded and unwanted in our community. The majority of the people spoke against it. More than 11,000 voters signed petitions against it. The elected officials found that the benefits did not outweigh the effects on neighbor farming operations. In other words, like spoiled children do, if you can't always win by the current rules, change the rules so you, that you can always win. OCAPA's idea that the Eugene Sand and Gravel versus Lane County case needs to be fixed is incorrect. The Eugene Sand and Gravel versus Lane County case does not need to be fixed. Another definition of fixed would be to fix the horse race before it started so that you are assured of a win. Our situation is very unique. It would be very difficult to find another situation like it in the state. Goal 5 rules are already slated heavily to the aggregate industry. It is a more than fair rule for them to follow. Many have been cited using the Goal 5 rule. Under HB 3013, DEQ would be the regulator for dust. However, DEQ has little or no capacity to enforce and no equipment to make the necessary measurements. Dust standards must be higher for agriculture than for humans. In other words, you can shovel gravel dust on a strawberry plant, and most likely you will not have any ill effects, and yet the plant will die. HB 3013 is premature. Before we can decide if we need to change the law, we must establish what aggregate is already available and permitted. For example, in our area, the other three main producers estimate 40-plus years of permitted gravel and 30 to 40 years anticipated reserves of aggregate for the future. If HB 3013 were to pass, gravel pits will be like 7-Elevens taking on the competitive structure of Walmart. Rich bottom farmland will cease to exist because mining is much more lucrative than farming. After all, this is all about money. I have included an expert from this morning's Register Guard, our local paper, where the headline is, "Leave Gravel Rule Alone." Thank you for your time.
Any questions of Ms. Jensen? Thank you for coming today and testifying.
Thank you for inviting me.
Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Lee Kirsten. I'm a lawyer who represented the farmers opposing the Eugene Sand and Gravel application in Lane County. I crossed out almost everything that I'd written because there's been so many amendments that came in and you wanted to hear more about policy issues, and I thought I'd share some of my thoughts on that. You're told there's a crisis in aggregate supply, and I can tell you that that is not true in Lane County. Evidence in the Eugene Sand matter reveals 40 years of inventoried supply and estimates over 100 years of non-inventoried supply. It also reveals a decreasing price per ton for aggregate. I've got the material over with your clerk to support those statements. If industry says there's inadequate supply, why don't they produce the records of inventoried sites, expected demand, and prove it? One of the reasons Eugene Sand lost at all levels is in part because they made broad statements that were unsupported by facts. The courts held industry to a proof standard. I would presume you would want to do the same thing. You're told there's a new so-called zero dust standard which will prohibit mining on all farmland. This is untrue. This standard, established in the Court of Appeals case and the Luba case that I wrote and argued, only applies to the facts fitting the Eugene Sand case. Those are very unique facts. They involve organics, integrated pest management systems, use of horses to reduce dust, direct marketing to the public of minimally processed farm products, Class 1 and Class 2 soils. Be very difficult to replicate those facts. Second, all decision makers in the Eugene Sand matter agreed there are sound scientific reasons why the DEQ dust standard should not be applicable to agriculture. The DEQ standard is set to protect human health. Accordingly, it addresses PM10 and smaller particles. The nose filters out large particles, so they are not regulated. This means the DEQ standard addresses specks of dust, not dirt clods. This is totally backwards for agriculture. Put another way, not only is the quality of dust regulated by the DEQ rule inappropriate for agriculture, but in the material I've left with your clerk is a number of references to scientific reports accepted by the Board of Commissioners in Lane County, Luba, and the Court of Appeals, all over the strenuous opportunity to object by Eugene Sand lawyers, who were denied without discussion by the Court of Appeals, that the quantity standard in some cases may be inappropriate to protect agriculture. As a policy matter, you already have a balancing rule. That's the Goal 5 rule. You already have a process. That's the Goal 5 rule. Industry participated in the creation of the rule. I participated in part of that behind the scenes. Industry was very influential in establishing that rule. From my perspective as a lawyer, it is so pro-aggregate industry that I know many land use lawyers who will not take aggregate cases because the skids are greased for the industry.
1 minute.
And they're virtually impossible for the opponents to prevail. The current process raises other issues in terms of the legislative rules. Things are involved now which were not in the original bill. I think you need to consider that. And there's been limited opportunity for public testimony on items that are now before this conference committee. The existing Goal 5 rule is already a balancing rule because it uses a significant impact on accepted agricultural practices and agricultural cost tests. This requires a crop-by-crop and farm-by-farm analysis. Surely, as a matter of policy, this is better than a one-size-fits-all DEQ standard derived for other purposes. The policy is kind of like the hen talking to the pig about ham and eggs for breakfast and how good that is. And the pig goes, yeah, because you make a contribution. To me, it's a life commitment.
Time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both, Greg. Steve Pfeiffer.
I'm sorry.
Well, we won't make you take another number and wait all the way through again.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Pfeiffer. I'm a land use attorney with a practice in Portland. And I come to you today to speak to only a small part of the issue before you, and that is what Mr. Kirsten just spoke about, and that's the 296 statute, which you've come to become very familiar with. First of all, I come to this issue from a variety of perspectives. First of all, I was the attorney, am the attorney for Eugene Sand throughout these proceedings. Secondly, I can tell you that through the last probably 5 to 6 years, and certainly since the 96 rewrite of the Goal 5 rule, I've represented and taken through the process probably 12 to 15 aggregate siting processes through the PAPA process. I can't recall a conditional use one, but more through the Goal 5 process. And third, I was chair of a subcommittee in 1996 of LCDC, which rewrote the Goal 5 rule, not only as to aggregate, but as to natural resources. And in that latter sense, I think I struggled along with others, both on and off the commission, with the balance question before you today. I want to make 2 points. First of all, before I do, I'm not here on behalf of Eugene Sand today, and I'm not here on behalf of any specific aggregate operator, and I don't even have an application pending at this time on an aggregate site, with the exception of one of my partners in a court of appeals case unrelated to this. Secondly, I don't believe, contrary to some of the testimony you've heard, that anything you do at this time will affect the Eugene Sand appellate process or its earlier permit denial. I don't think it can. The case is postured in such a way that it couldn't have any effect with one possible exception, and that's to the extent that Eugene Sand decided to struggle and come forward with a new application and go through a similar 4-year and quite expensive process under a new rule you might establish. Short of that, you're not going to affect that appellate decision. So it's really only that experience that I bring to you. And my point would be this. During the 1996 rewrite of the Goal 5 rule and the 2 years prior to that that it took, and as Lee pointed out, it involved a lot of people of a lot of persuasion, one of the key components of that was to put some consistency into the process of aggregate siting statewide. It's not unusual to have a room full of opponents and very few supporters of an aggregate mine for reasons you might understand. There aren't a lot of people out there in the immediate realm who are going to come out on a Tuesday night and stand up in support of an aggregate operation. On the other hand, it's a statewide issue, it's a statewide policy, and it's even more so today than it was in 96. The commission at the time decided to try and make an effort to make it a consistent rule statewide. It's one of three examples where the state has preempted local land use decision making. The other two are prison siting and light rail siting. In other words, the rule is very clear, and the courts have upheld that the criteria in that rule are binding on local government with very little discretion, unlike many other land use matters. To that end, there's a provision in the rule that applies only in every instance except where conflicts or impacts, potential or otherwise, with farm practices are at issue. That provision says any time there's an omission or a discharge or other impact which is governed by a state or federal or local permit, DEQ, federal permit, or the like, if the applicant can demonstrate that they meet the criteria for that state or federal permit, they are deemed to be in compliance with the Goal 5 rule. The one exception that was left out as a matter of policy was 296. That protection doesn't exist, as Lee pointed out, with regard to farmland. For instance, the LARAPA or DEQ air contaminant discharge permit was uncontested in the Eugene Sand case. There is a higher standard for agriculture. That standard predated the Goal 5 rule. In other words, that statute for 296, no significant increase in the cost of farming practices, was long before the Goal 5 rule. The commission put it in because it was frankly tried and true. But it is the one exception which doesn't apply to that safe harbor statewide. Now, I'm the first one to say I've been through a lot of these processes and a lot of night hearings along with Lee and others. And it has generally worked. But in the Eugene Sand case, and this is where I don't have any interest in the case itself, but as it applies statewide, something has gone wrong. We now have a situation where the court has said, in that case, a no-dust discharge standard is appropriate. The locals can make that call under 296, and at that point, the process comes to a grinding halt. To that end, I would urge you to adopt what in my version is Section 2, but the OCAPR proposal that would substitute 296 for compliance with another state or federal permit as evidence of irrefutable compliance with 296 to take that discretion off the table. Absent that, I disagree with Lee. It is not confined to these facts. It is a statewide rule now that at any point a city or a county generally can decide that that kind of impact exists or they want to set that local standard of no discharge, be it dust, water, flooding, or anything in between. It will be upheld. It's evident. And it will be upheld across the state in every forum. And I and other people who advise aggregate operators whether they want to take what often is a $600,000 to $1 million soft cost exercise to go through a land use permitting process,
time,
will tell them you had better think twice, given that rule if it remains in effect.
Representative Stark,
I have one question, sir. And this question is also for Mr. Kirsten, Ms. McLaren, Ms. Sherton, and anybody else who's an expert in this, Mr. Angstrom. So it's not just directed at you. Is there any way you can mine gravel with no dust?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler.
It's okay. It happens all the time.
Sorry. I've read more dust reports than I care to admit. My response is twofold. First of all, I think it would be exceedingly impossible, if not exceedingly difficult, to do so. In the Eugene Sand case, and admittedly, this comes from our dust expert. The deposition off-site of the dust from that mine on the off-site fields was estimated to be, and I'm doing this from memory, a quarter of a teaspoon per month per square meter. And I can be corrected by Lee or others if my recollection's wrong. That's the amount of discharge in that particular instance, and it is limited to that particular instance. To reduce that to zero would be very difficult. Secondly, farming is a dusty business. I grew up on farms and ranches. It's rare that I came off that tractor clean. And there's a basic background situation out there which is impossible to quantify, as our dust expert told us. So that's what our deposition was. That's without regard to the deposition that comes from farming activities in the area onto those same fields. Third and last, I would tell you that regardless of what we might agree in this room we could do in terms of eliminating dust and the like, there will always be a debate, as there was in Eugene Sand. I gave you our sense of what our engineer consultant said, and Lee and his clients obviously had a different view in terms of dust that would show up on their blueberries, peaches, or otherwise. Mm. The point is, it's always a debate, as it always is in a land use process, and as you see daily. There is no way you can avoid the conflict. That means a Board of County Commissioners will have to make a call, as they did in Eugene Sand. They will base it on the testimony of Lee's clients versus our expert, Lee's people, their experts. You'll never know until you go through that four-year process which way that decision-maker will decide, which pair of sweaty palms they'll choose to approve or reject, and finally whether LUBA will choose to look behind that and see if there was really a substantial evidence in body of in support of that. So it's a highly subjective process. And again, I have an operator ask me, what are we going to do given Eugene Sand? I mean, you really expect me to go forward with that kind of a soft cost exercise, both human and dollar cost? And I'm going to tell you, at the end of the day, I don't care how many scientists you line up, you'll have equal numbers on both sides. It'll fall to a decision. It'll fall to politics. It'll fall to a situation where we have 11,000 people signing a petition saying we'd rather not have the mine in our neighborhood. And I'm not sure what the answer to that one is.
Any other questions, Mr. Farmer? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, we have two panels left. So,
pardon me, Mr. Chair. I was asked if the industry could meet the zero dust standard, and my name was mentioned. And would you like my answer to that?
Please, I asked it. Sure, you bet.
You have to re-identify yourself, if you will, sir.
Thank you. My name is Lee Kirsten. There is no zero dust standard. That rule only applied to the facts applicable in the Eugene Sand case. Other applicants would need to have identical facts in order to have that standard applied to their case. Thank you.
Thank you.
Liz Frankel and Linda Ludwig. And then, committee, we will bring three of the agencies forward so that we can... Good afternoon, Linda and Liz.
Liz Frankel for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And to identify myself, our League Action Committee met on Tuesday and discussed how we would deal with this, because we assumed that this would be a moving target. There would be amendments that we hadn't seen. We didn't know how to approach this. So what we did was sort of establish some guidelines for ourselves, and we're sharing those with you as to how we would look at whatever gets out on the table. And for the record, I did call all of the state leagues yesterday just to find out what the interest in aggregate was, what the local leagues, because I operate on the state level. The local leagues operate, they're the ones that go to the county commission and the city planning commission and so on. And it was very interesting, because this is, like you know, one hot topic. And I will also point out something that some of you haven't been around as long as I have. In other words, when I started dealing with the aggregate industry and the conflicts, I was dealing with Rick's father, not with Rick. I've been around a while. The League, first of all, cares very deeply, of course, about public access, the ability of the public to speak, and I'm reminded of the 11,000 people who signed a petition. One of the things that one would like to avoid is that kind of situation. One of the ways you avoid that is by having an open discussion. We're somewhat concerned. One of the batches of the amendments talks about a task force. And I looked up the rules under which that task force would operate. And the rules talked about, and this was very interesting, it gave authority for the legislative committee to command testimony, to command evidence. It did a number of things. A powerful committee. It has no reference whatsoever as to the role of the public. It makes no reference either in the amendments or when you look up the statutes under which it suggests that they would operate. There's nothing about the role of the public. And I do think the public cares, and I think one of the ways in which you deal with, try to avoid the 11,000 petition stuff, which is not a good way of making decisions, policy decisions. Going on, let me say that I also feel that if there is to be an interim legislative committee, everything should be on the table. You don't predispose that committee by saying, we're going to deal with this, this, and this, and maybe not this. We're going to, in other words, keep that. Everything should be on the table. It's well to remember when you're looking at the resources like aggregate, forest resources, agricultural resources. Aggregate is an unusual resource in the sense that trees do regrow. Agriculture grows a new crop every year. aggregate, once the aggregate is gone, it's gone. So one of the things one needs to do is to begin to look at what the future is and how we're going to deal with that. Because I don't think anyone wants the entire good soil in the Willamette Valley to be lost to aggregate. That's not a balancing act. Finally, two other things. One is, one of the problems that you get into when you start dealing with no dust, dust, all these kinds of problems, it's clear that you need something like Goal 5, where you have a venue to work these issues out. If all of this is left to local counties, one of the problems you deal with is enforcement. They don't have the staff. They don't know how to enforce a lot of these things. So you have to think about how this plays into this whole problem. Finally, the League would very much would be willing to work with a work group. We would be willing to work with a legislative committee. As I say, we are concerned about how that committee is structured and whether it's merely balanced because we have a balance of legislators or whether there's some other kind of balance. This is a big issue for this state, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I'd like to express my apology, particularly Liz. Liz is one of my constituents, but I've got an urgent meeting that I need to attend, but I'm really torn because this is a major issue as well. So with your blessings, I need to be excused.
Certainly you're excused, Senator. We understand that meeting is also very important. Good morning, Liz, or good afternoon.
Long day.
It's almost time to quit.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Linda Ludwig, League of Oregon Cities. I very much want to thank the chair for his recognition of municipal concerns with this issue. Although there are not a lot of extraction sites within city limits, there are certainly a lot of sites within the state that are within the UGB and close to city limits that have significant impacts on the residents of those cities. I have just a couple of comments relevant to the amendments and the discussions that I've heard this week. I would like very much to concur with Mr. Egan and the governor's office and the AOC representatives about this interim committee and the look-see there, and the need to broaden that to include full representation, local government representation, and also, I believe, municipal representation on that interim work group. Also, I would squarely like to put on the table at this time, there's been discussion from Mr. Angstrom as of the industry lobbyist with his intent, if not in this legislation, in subsequent legislation, to move that local permitting process to the statewide process through DOGAMI. And I just would like to put the committee on notice that was something that munis in the state would have significant concerns with. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you again for the opportunity to come forward today.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative?
Yeah, I just want to make one comment and then one question. But Ms. Frankel, aggregate is recyclable. I've recycled my share of concrete, I assure you. And then my question is, and this is at Mr. Angstrom too, there's been a lot of discussion about the farmland in Willamette Valley, which I drive through every morning. It's beautiful. I want to protect it too. I eat. What percentage of land, how many acres of arable land under use right now, farmland, are in Willamette Valley? And then how many acres are being mined? Now, if you don't have that, it's okay. But I would like to know those amounts, because sometimes it's a very highly emotionally charged issue. I don't think no matter what happens, we're going to dig up all Willamette Valley. For aggregate, but how many arable acres are in the Willamette Valley, and how many of those acres are currently being mined for aggregate? I think that's a little more perspective on this.
Certainly, Liz.
I think that it's very likely that is an appropriate question to ask the folks over at the LCD, particularly the folks, the ag folks. They have some data. I think that probably their data may need some a GIS expert to put it all together, but I think they have some answers there that might be very, very helpful to your committee.
Thank Perhaps you. Our final panel representative
coming up
will be able to address that.
Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, ladies.
Thank you.
And our state agencies, Bob Rindy, LCDC, Doug Tindell, MoDOT, and is Vicki O'Connell from Dogami. Committee, this is our final panel.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Chair Girard and members of the committee. I'm Doug Tindall. I'm the state maintenance engineer for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm not going to talk today about any particular amendments. I'm just going to talk about ODOT's need for aggregate. Aggregate's a very valuable resource to us, both for building roads and for operational activities such as sanding roads to maintain adequate traction during the winter. And not only just having aggregate, but having aggregate in a plentiful supply. There was an audit that was done recently at ODOT that indicated that when there are multiple sources of aggregate in an area, we tend to get better prices for road building contracts. ODOT has around 800 sites across the state. Not many of those can be considered significant because they are either not the quality nor the quantity, or in many cases not both, to meet the tests of Goal 5. So, for instance, our sanding rock would be a good example of that. It's a very poor quality rock. It doesn't meet the test of Goal 5, and so none of those sites can be considered significant. So Goal 5 doesn't alone, without the conditional use process, does not do what we need to do in order to be able to use our sites. What we need out of whatever comes out of this process, we need a bill that allows us to use our existing sites and that provides adequate aggregate at reasonable cost to for the long term to construct and maintain the state highway system. And so that's what we're looking for as we see specific sets of amendments. My comments will be: this set of amendments does that, or this set of amendments doesn't do that, or it does it with some qualification. So I'm just expressing our need and what we need to accomplish. Thank you.
Mr. Tindall, with the passing of the Transportation Act, how much of an impact as far as aggregate needs will that have on the Department of Transportation?
Chair Gore, there's an impact probably not as significant as if we would have had that amount of money available for just generally building roads. A lot of the work, more than half of the work described in that revenue package that passed, is going to be bridges, which are not as aggregate as intensive as roadways are. So there's an impact there. In terms of will this run us out of the current supply without the conditionally permitted sites, I'm not sure. Probably not would be my guess. But it's certainly going to, as you've heard before, it is more work than we were going to do before, and so it does have an impact in terms of using up the aggregate sites that are out there now.
Any other, Senator Shields?
Yeah, Doug, your answer was probably not. As much as a week ago, I think we began asking the question as to the impact of this bill and what kind of trouble you'd be in if we couldn't reach the compromise on this bill. Can you give us any information on any subsequent conversations you've had around the department or with other departments with regard to this need?
Chair Girard, Senator Shields, since I don't know the total inventory of all of the aggregate sites that are out there, privately owned aggregate sites that are out there in terms of the construction, is why I waffle on that statement. I can tell you in terms of our sites that we would not be able to use because they're permitted intermittently. There is a direct impact to the ODOT-owned sites that we would use or we would not be able to use without a bill going forward. But in terms of the total amount of aggregate that's out in the state or currently under permit in the state. I can't tell you exactly, and that's why I waffled on that answer.
Thank you.
I got one last one for you, Mr. Dindo. If the inventory of aggregate within the state boundaries of Oregon were not available enough, where would you go to buy aggregate?
Chair Girard, I suppose a neighboring state was probably the answer to that question. I think of this in terms of Standing Rock, but let me just talk about that one in particular. We would be faced with sort of a test of how much money we had versus how much value you could derive from being able to sand roadways. It is expensive. The 25 cents per mile that Mr. Angster mentioned can be a huge cost. So I would assume that we would go to a neighboring state. We would try and haul it as short a distance as we could possibly haul it. But we may not go and get. We wouldn't use the volume that we're using now in terms of sanding roadways.
Okay. Thank you very much. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I'm not sure that I can add a great deal from the testimony you've already heard today. I apologize. I have a little bit of an allergy. I thought it was a building, but maybe it's dust. I'm not sure. LCDC spent about 2 years in trying to find a balance between farming and aggregate concluded in 1996. They did so because leading up to that, there had been a process in place. A series of court cases had ultimately resulted in a lot of uncertainty as to the process for Goal 5. So we got the Farm Bureau and the OCAPA into the governor's office for a series of meetings, and they came out with a 10-point agreement that said, here's how we're going to balance this. LCDC adopted that rule based on the agreement. And here we are, 7 or 8 years later, and again we have court cases that have, I think, thrown us back into turmoil as to the process. That's the reason that we have supported some solution legislatively to these court cases. I can't give you a position for the agency as to exactly how that balancing will take place. I really had hopes at the beginning of the session that we could find a solution similar to the one we had in 96, where both sides would agree. If we don't have that, obviously you're going to have to, in some manner, split the baby on this or reach some sort of compromise. Because I do agree with those parties who have urged you to do something here to reinstate the conditional use process. When LCDC adopted the Goal 5 process, it was intended for large aggregate sites, over 2 million tons in the valley. And LCDC intentionally left alone entirely the conditional use process, which had been operating for decades, I think, and for which there was no testimony in opposition or pro stating that that process was a problem. The result of that is that we have today a process for large sites, and until that case, most siting decisions of smaller sites have happened through the conditional use process. I heard it's something like in the area of 95% of all the aggregate mines that get approved statewide. We can't go back, I think, as quickly as you can through legislation and recreate a process for small mines. I think what we need to do is what has been discussed so far, certainly outside this room and to some extent in this room, and that is to try to find an interim fix here for these cases so that we can go forward with a conditional use process and in some manner think about whether there need to be long-term changes and what those are. So that next session we could perhaps have a much more thoughtful proposal. I know this is what the governor's office has also supported, and I think we would be happy to work on a work group or in some other manner to help you achieve that. With that, I'll conclude, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Any questions, Mr. Rindy? Thank you, Bob. Boy, got out. That's good. Ms. O'Connell.
Good afternoon, Chair Girard and committee members. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm with the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. And I have very little to offer as new information. What I supplied you is a two-page written testimony, and since we were pretty sure we would not know exactly what all the amendments that were going to be proposed were, we really fell back onto discussing Senator Morse's memo to the Legislative Council, making some suggestions on what some of the amendments should be. And there's really the three main items that, as we see it and as where our concerns are. And the first is that we strongly support the suggestion that there should be an interim discussion on these matters, either a task force or Legislative Council type of membership. We would be happy to be involved in that. We would hope that you would consider us as part of the discussion. These issues are much more complex, and they're getting more complex every day in trying to decide how to fix this. The second item is that we certainly suggest and support going back to some type of conditional use permitting in our program two, which is our mineral lands regulation and reclamation program. We have about 850 sites that we are working with regulating and reclamation, and the vast majority of those are the CUPs. So that will have a really profound effect on how we are operating. And then the third part is the issue on in this case, the dust standard, or in changing or addressing some of the standards that are in the statutes. And again, that's a very complex issue, and there are issues there that really need a little bit more time to be discussed, and we suggest that could be addressed in the interim committees. And other than questions, we thank you very much for allowing us to summarize and to say that we also agree with the governor's office on most of their testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Shaw.
Mr. Chair. And kind of tying in with Mr. Rindy's comment, I hope the next meeting we have some language that's a little more concrete that we can look at.
You're digging yourself a hole.
My question that I asked Ms. Frankel, and I'm sure you didn't bring this information with you, but not just arable, the currently under farm use, because arable land is, there's a lot of land that we can't farm for many reasons. It's arable, but we don't farm. How many acres are being farmed in the Willamette Valley right now, and how many acres are being used to mine? I'd like that information. And on the dust issue, all you experts out there, I don't want to just know if it's possible for zero dust, but I want it broken into increments of how much it costs to keep that dust out too, because I'm sure you could do something with no dust at a prohibitive cost, but relative to how much it costs. And I'm not asking you to answer.
Right, and we were leafing through our information to see if we at least had the acreage on hand for in the Willamette Valley for the mine land, but we can certainly get that information to you right away. And just a couple of quick comments on the dust issue. It would be, in my experience, I would say that it would be impossible to mine with zero dust. There are ways you could do it, and you're absolutely right. One of those ways would be to keep everything wet all the time, but it would be extremely expensive. And the other problem with that, from a scientific point of view, and something that I always think about when I hear these discussions, is exactly how you would monitor for that type of situation. For example, if right now Dogami has a certain part of the dust issue. We have a small part where we are supposed to monitor or check mine sites for what we call fugitive dust, which means not the dust that's created from the crushing operation, but actually the dust that may be created on the haul road within the site, the mine site, that type of dust. And we do not require constant monitoring for that because it would be extremely expensive for both us and for the company. So what we do is that we mitigate. If we observe with our field visits that there's a lot of dust being caused, then we sit down and try to work out a solution to where we can mitigate the amount of dust. But we certainly don't expect for there to be constant monitoring of that dust.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, in 1996, when we were writing the Goal 5 rules, the department did a back-of-the-envelope kind of study, and basically we receive from counties information on all the numerous approvals on EFU land, which is farmland. It's not the same as you were asking versus arable land, but for EFU. And as you've heard earlier, there are many, many farm and non-farm uses allowed on EFU land under Oregon law. In 96, that study showed that the amount of acreage that was being consumed for mining, as opposed to all the numerous other uses, housing, golf courses, and a number of other things, that mining was very much, I think it was at next to the bottom of the list. I can't remember the numbers associated with that, but it was not a great deal of land. Now, we have tried numerous times since then to do a better study. In fact, about a year ago, when we were asked to look at this issue, we called in OCAPA and the Farm Bureau for a couple of meetings in the director's office to see if we could find some way to get them to share funding for the study, to do a study exactly as you described. We weren't able to achieve that. It is probably going to have some expense, and I don't know exactly where that money is going to come from, but we strongly support that kind of study be done. And that is the kind of thing that this interim committee could be charged with doing. I think there is actually a lot of data needs. That's one of them that would really help us get a handle on this. And unfortunately, those studies haven't been done. And as we try to do them, we find that there isn't funding to do that.
Senator Shields.
I'm kind of fascinated by your concept of the list and the, you know, the aggregate sites being number two from the bottom. I'm assuming these lists would include such things as golf courses. And so to compare a golf course and an aggregate pit, I mean, I'd like to have a golf course next to my house. You know, I don't think you get a lot of signatures saying, no, don't put one here. You know, so what I would suggest is maybe the question needs to be refined a little bit to limit it to, and I don't know how you do this because this would be subjective too, I guess, but there's kind of positive non-uses, and then there's kind of negative, you know, non-EFU uses. Although the Farm Bureau would want to be farming them all, and I understand that. But you're comparing apples and oranges, is I guess what I'm saying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I agree. And as I say, that was a quick and dirty calculation. I shouldn't have implied that we would do the study that way again. I think what we would like to know is the acreage that has been mined and that is not reclaimable as farmland, and versus the farming land that's left. And that may be even the wrong way to ask the question, but I just wanted to agree with you that we would like to have that data. Some way or another, I think it would really help us, and we haven't been able to do that.
Follow-up question. Bob, you just said reclaimable as farmland, and maybe we need to be talking to somebody from the Ag Department about this, but when you say you start out with type 1 and type 2 soils, when you talk about reclaiming it as farmland, would you be reclaiming it as type 1 and type 2 soils, or would it end up 3 and 4 or whatever? I mean, you know what I'm saying? would it come back as the same high quality farmland or not when you reclaim?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, that's probably a question that other experts besides myself would have to answer. We've also discussed it, and what we've heard is that if you don't dig a very deep hole and you very carefully take care of the soil, that the chances are much higher that you can reclaim it. And I have heard that there are examples of where it has been reclaimed. Mm-hmm. And very likely, if it's a very, very deep hole and you don't have any way to fill it up, and it's not reclaimable. I don't know what those economics are. I don't know whether there's a science to doing it. But I suspect that almost in no cases would you be able to put the soil back in a way that's exactly the way it was before you mined it. But I do think it's likely that you can put it back in a way that will produce crops, depending on how you do it and how expensive it is.
Senator Shields, may I ask one of my staff to come up and answer that question in a little detail? We are the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program, and they do have some experience with that, if that would be okay.
Sure.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Randy Moore, and I work in the Mine Land Reclamation Group in the Albany office. Part of our charge is to see that mine sites get reclaimed to a beneficial secondary use. And we do this through a process of conditioning permits. We do have quite a few sites that are reclaimed to farmland. And some of these permits we can condition where they salvage topsoil or high-quality soils separate from other soils or overburden. These are stockpiled separately and then reapplied as a final top coat in similar thicknesses as to what existed prior to the mining. And we feel that these lands can be brought back to comparable quality soils or at least close to what their productivity was prior to the mining. With that said, a lot of the sites within the valley become holes and are reclaimed to other uses, wetlands, wildlife, things like that. But if we were charged with returning them to a high-quality soil or class soil, we feel we could accomplish that.
Any other questions?
Mr. Representative Morgan. Indulge me. Randy, I think that it's no secret that just the philosophy behind what's going on in reclaiming mine sites has changed pretty radically over the last few years. And it might be interesting for the panel. I don't imagine you've already been through this, but I'd be real interested if you could kind of talk to us a little bit about where it's evolving from and to.
Well, when the program started, was authorized in 72, a lot of the initial permits really didn't look too closely at the reclamation process and consequences of what was going on post-mining. I think in the last few years, we've taken a very proactive role in making sure sites along river corridors become beneficial, whether it's in terms of productive use, whether it's for some type of salmonid habitat. We've had studies that have shown that we can actually increase the benefits in the river, make the complexity more favorable to endangered fish by engineering these sites correctly. Our permits now generally, again, we can condition our permits any way we feel is necessary to achieve not just safe mining, which doesn't impact neighboring lands or off-site resources, but also to accomplish what the reclamation goals are. And we've become a lot more, again, proactive in getting the current scientific information to make sure that we are doing things in the best possible way and conditioning the permits so as those things are accomplished. And then to go along with that, the sites are bonded. There is a security there where if something happens to the operator, there is a funding to accomplish the reclamation.
have a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So is it a correct statement to make that we now have an understanding of a greater understanding of the relationships of the elements that are under consideration in terms of being able to restore the site to different end uses? And so would it be safe to say that we now have a workable understanding of how to restore the site to enhance wetland attributes, or how to restore a site to enhance agricultural land attributes, or that kind of thing? Is that a fair statement to make?
Very much so. These things are always an evolution. As the demands on the land become higher, population pressures and things like that, the land becomes a more valuable commodity. And we learn as we go along. Laws change, standards change, and we are constantly moving to meet those standards and those laws for the reclamation. And also, studies are constantly being done. There's things that we did in the past that weren't the best practices, and we know that now. And we are incorporating new studies, new findings, and best practices into how we look to reclaim sites or have them reclaimed by the operators.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Shields.
It occurs to me that DGAMI and ODOT and LCDC have all done a fine job, but we also have, I think, somebody here from the Department of Agriculture that might want to comment on that. Is Jim Johnson still here?
We'll go ahead and dismiss this panel. Thank you, gentlemen.
The question, Jim, I'd just like to kind of have your take on this whole issue of soil reclamation as you've seen it from the Department of Agriculture and what's going on in that arena.
Chair Girard, Senator Shields, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With all due respect to my colleagues, I would disagree that agricultural land can be reclaimed back to the same capability that it was before it was mined. There are numerous studies out there, and I've got a bunch back in my bag if you'd like to take a look at them, that really talk about to get something back to the capability that I had before is going to require quite a deal of input into that soil through fertilizers and the like, and most studies show that it never is actually totally brought back to the same capacity that it was originally. When you mine topsoil or you take topsoil off, it's basically accelerated erosion. And what erosion does to topsoil is it affects the organic matter of that soil, which basically addresses, it basically affects how it holds its nutrients, how it holds its water, its ability to retain water, its ability to drain water. While you can restore land back to some capability for agricultural production, it's never going to be exactly the same as it was before.
Mr. Chairman,
I
think that you know, again, my expertise in this field is just an inch deep. But my understanding is that there is a top layer of topsoil which has all the active microorganisms in it and things like that. And that if you destroy that, then the soil that's underneath that doesn't have the productivity capabilities. And given that there are, of course, drainage issues and depth of soils in different classes and compositions, issues related to that, I guess I don't understand why you wouldn't have the ability, if you knew where you were going before you actually started the project, to be able to set aside different parts of the composition of the overburden so that you could reconstruct it in much the same way. And I would hesitate to make any kind of representation that you would end up with exactly what you had before, but perhaps to introduce a concept that the economic development aspects and the wealth that was created by the undertaking plus the plan to restore the land to a condition as similar as possible, or perhaps even enhanced. If there were issues with the site before you started, would be well within the realm of possibility and probability.
Chair Gerard, Representative Morgan, I don't disagree that it's better to take the soil off in layers and try to put it back in those layers. But what our experience has shown, and whether it's a mining project or a pipeline project, for example, one going through Washington County with Northwest Natural, for example, and putting the soil back in there, they're not mining very deep, it's just a trench, is that regardless of how careful you are to put the soil back in exactly the same layers, once you disturb that soil, it's never exactly the same because it affects the living aspects of the soil. Soil is organic and it's living, and so moving that soil or changing that is going to impact some of its abilities to address some of those characteristics I talked about previously. It is, you know, if it's going to be done, if there's something that's going to be mined, soil is going to be disturbed, that accelerated erosion occurs, yes, it is. The better you can take it out by the layers and put it back on the same layers, the better chances are you're going to get it back to some comparable productivity, but it's never going to be the same as it was before.
Okay, and I would also just add to make it very clear that I'm not sure that there is a overriding value to having it be the same as it was before, as long as there is an ability to restore it to a comparable kind of a status.
Chair Gerard, Representative Morgan, that's a policy decision. I don't disagree. That's some, you know, we have to do that balancing.
Thank you.
Any other questions, Mr. Johnson?
Since you're here, Mr. Johnson, earlier today we had testimony about agricultural crops and sensitivity to dust. And, of course, the Eugene sand and gravel case has raised a great deal of dust, you might say. Why... And can you explain a little bit about this? Why is DEQ's standard for people maybe not appropriate for crops?
Chair Gerard, Senator Shields, I'm not an expert on DEQ standard. I can tell you that part of the problem here that in terms of looking at dust standards, and that's what's so great about the 215-296 standard, is that it's flexible enough to look at the situation, is that it relates to what type of agriculture is going on in an area. And when you talk about horticultural surfaces associated with the Willamette floodplain, you're talking about some of the most diverse agricultural areas in the state of Oregon. You could have upwards of 100 to 150 different crops being grown in those areas. And each of those crops are going to react differently to dust, and each of those crops are going to react differently to dust as it relates to what type of product you're proposing to do there. I heard testimony today that agriculture creates dust. Yes, it does. Dust is going to impact the grass seed industry differently than it's going to impact an organic orchardist. I wouldn't know any organic orchardist out there who would create dust on purpose or even try, or they were going to try to, because it does impact the quality of their product. If a quarry was surrounded by extensive small grains and grass seed operations, the impacts are going to be different from dust than your more intensive row crops.
Mr. Chair, if I
might,
I would assume that there's been agricultural activities in the lowlands of the Willamette Valley for hundreds of years in this state, and there has also been rock kinds of activities going on in the state for probably not quite that long, but certainly a very long period of time. And I would hesitate truly to draw a very strong detrimental impact based on the history of agriculture in the Willamette Valley and the history of aggregate extraction or rock mining in the Willamette Valley, and even attempt to draw any kind of a correlation that's detrimental. I mean, I hate to get into a situation where we talk about the quality of the arguments here, but this one seems to me to be pretty hair-splitting. I don't even know if you want to comment on that.
Well, I do.
Obviously, we're into the area of interpretation and policy, but I have real difficulty taking this seriously.
Well, I would like to respond to that, Chair Girard, Representative Morgan. I think this gets back to what some of the testimony you heard, and that is what are the specifics of the fact in the case. If you look at the evidence that was provided in the Lane County case, there was strong and substantial evidence presented as to the type of agriculture that was going on there, a type of agriculture that quite frankly didn't exist in the Willamette Valley not that many years ago, and that is an organic agriculture that's especially crop agriculture that's focused on farm markets for an urban audience. That, quite frankly, didn't really exist that many years ago, and it is much more sensitive to some of the issues related to dust or other things than your more common agriculture that's existed in the Willamette Valley for years and years. I agree with the comments that were made that the facts in that case are specific to the facts in that case. I don't think we can say that I agree with what you're saying, Representative Morgan, that in most cases it's probably not. But in this specific case, the evidence in the record, and I've seen the record, is pretty strong to show that dust was a problem or is a problem with the specialty crops that are being grown in that area.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
Committee, that concludes the invited testimony today's session, and it's obvious from the testimony that we've heard, we do indeed have a long-term issue and a short-term issue to address. Any committee member like to make a comment at this point?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, we have just distributed amendments, -7 amendments, and they are reflective of the direction that I had asked OCAPA to take in terms of creating something that I think will work for all parties. And so I just want to make that statement clear that this is an amendment that's directed by me as a member and not by, excuse me, not by OCAPA.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. Mr. Angstrom, Mr. Schellenberg, Mr. Shipley, would you? Is Brian still here?
Yeah.
Would you come up for a moment? You know, you sit here and you listen to all the testimony and you realize that the only way this committee is going to be able to, I believe, arrive at some kind of conclusion and some kind of direction, given the limited time period that we have, is that I would like... There's no way I can not omit somebody. You know, I'm sitting here making a list of people who have vital interest in this bill. And I get up to 10, and I'm starting to think, there's no way you can do things with 10 people. We do have a short-term issue and a long-term issue. And what I believe we need to address presently are the short-term issues. What I'm going to ask Mr. Shipley to do is to mediate between just Mr. Schellenberg and just Mr. Angstrom. And I was going to give you 15 people to mediate, Brian, but to be honest with you, these are the two principles involved in the problem that this committee needs to see if it needs solving and if there is a solution to find. Committee, with your approval, I would like to ask Mr. Shipley to work with Mr. Angstrom and Mr. Schellenberg and come back to this committee in 5 days. We can't get a date earlier than the 13th because of everyone on this committee is very busy and very involved and conflicts. So the 13th is the earliest we can reconvene this committee. But I would like you, Mr. Shipley, and I would charge you to work with Mr. Angstrom and Mr. Schellenberg. Mr. Angstrom has the and I think we should start with the dash sevens of Senator Morris's. And Don, yours are the dash sixes, right? Start with those two amendments and work to find a solution to come back to this committee, which we can take action on the 13th at 3 o'clock. Committee, any comments? Senator Shields.
You're chairing the committee, and I certainly want to leave it in your hands. I would hope that if Brian is working with the two principals, that he'll certainly have free rein to talk with all these others that have been volunteering today. I mean, whether it's counties, municipalities, whether it's Thousand Friends, whether it's, you know, because there's a plethora of thought out there that we need to try and incorporate into this whole thing.
Well, I could always throw Mr. Rindy into the pot with you if you... I'm going to ask you directly.
I think he's trying to hide.
Yeah, I know. You didn't make it to the door in time, Bob. So, is there any other person who has testified today that the three of you feel should be included in these discussions that I have omitted?
Chair Garrard.
Identify yourself first.
For the record, my name is Brian Shipley. I believe that the counties did present some amendments and have some specific issues, and I think that at least Art Schlack from Association of Counties would have some pretty significant input in the process.
Any objection from anyone on the committee, then we will add Mr. Schlack to that group. Any further comment from committee members? We will meet again at 3 p.m. on the 13th of August in this building. And good luck, gentlemen. We need you to work hard.
Thank you, Chair Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought you were going to give us 15 minutes.
Committee, thank you very much. Committee on House Bill 3013 is adjourned. Yeah.